Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
We're diving deep today into a really significant work of modern literature. It often feels less like a novel and, well, more like a diagnosis of some of the modern world's deepest splits. Orhan Pamuk's 2002 book, Snow or Car. And Pamuk, I mean, we're talking about a Nobel laureate here. His whole body of work seems dedicated to chronicling Turkey's really fascinating, complex, sometimes quite painful identity crisis, that kind of collision point between East and West.
Exactly. And what's so vital about Snow, I think, is how it marks a bit of a shift for Pamuk. He's known for historical fiction, sure, but here. Well, here he turns his focus squarely onto the turbulent political present of 1990s Turkey.
Right.
This feels like Pamuk at his most, let's say, overtly political. He's taking these big philosophical ideas, faith, doubt, melancholy, and planting them right in the heart of those explosive debates defining the era. You know, secularism versus religious freedom, and particularly the whole headscarf issue, which is so polarizing.
So that's really our mission for you today, isn't it? To try and unpack this literary and ideological pressure cooker.
Yeah.
How does the intensely private stuff a poet looking for lost love, for artistic inspiration, how does that collide so violently with the lethal certainty of political and religious extremism?
Yeah.
It's a story where personal desire just gets swallowed up by history.
It really is. And it all starts with our protagonist, Kavane. He's a Turkish poet described as deeply melancholic. He spent 12 years in political exile over in Frankfurt.
Okay.
He comes back to Turkey and travels to this remote, impoverished, snow-covered city called Kars, right on the border.
Kars.
Officially, he tells people he's a journalist. He's there to investigate this tragic wave of suicides among young women, the headscarf girls, as they're called. They felt pushed by the secular state, you know, forced to choose between education and their faith.
But that's not the whole story.
No. The deeper driver, the real pull for him, is İpek. His first love, she lives in Kars.
Ah, okay. So Kars itself, we need to talk about this setting because it sounds like it's much more than just a backdrop. It's almost driving the plot and the snow.
Well,
the snow is key.
Absolutely central. The whole narrative hinges on this powerful, relentless snowstorm that hits almost the second Kar arrives.
Wow.
And this snow just cuts the city off completely. For three incredibly intense days, Kars is sealed off from the world. It becomes this claustrophobic stage, a perfect microcosm of Turkey, really.
How so?
Because all the nation's competing ideologies, its warring factions, they're all trapped there together. They can't escape. They can't even call the capital. You've got the militant secularists, the hardline Islamists, frustrated Kurdish nationalists, all simmering in this isolated pot.
But wait, if Kars is so isolated, so remote, doesn't that make it less representative of Turkey as a whole? How does Pamuk make this frozen border town feel like a universal stage for this national crisis?
Well, I think it's precisely the isolation that lets the political drama escalate so quickly without any outside checks or balances.
Mm-hmm.
Ankara isn't watching, you know, so the internal tensions just boil over almost instantly.
Okay, that makes sense.
And the snow itself, Kar, it becomes this incredibly potent, shifting symbol. On one hand, yes, it represents political coldness, maybe indifference, this blanket covering up the city's darker history.
Right.
But for Kar, it becomes something more profound, almost spiritual, you could say. It actually sparks his poetic inspiration, something he hasn't felt in years. There's that key line, isn't there? The snow reminded Ka of God.
That's fascinating. So the snow isolates the city politically, creating the conditions for violence. But at the same time, it sort of opens Ka up spiritually, makes him vulnerable to, well, something transcendent.
Yes, exactly. He's this alienated secular intellectual. He's searching, really, for three lost things.
Mm-hmm.
His poetry, love, and maybe some kind of faith, or at least a feeling of connection to something larger.
But Kars is hardly neutral ground for that kind of search.
Not at all. The reality hits him fast. He realizes pretty quickly that neutrality, just being an observer, it's impossible there. No matter how much he might want to just retreat into the beauty of the falling snow.
He arrives wanting to be detached, the poet, the journalist.
But he's immediately dragged right into the middle of all these conflicts.
Okay. Let's shift focus then to the key players in this chaos, because they really do feel like living embodiments of Turkey's divided soul, don't they? If Ka represents doubt, who are the figures standing for absolute certainty?
Well, you absolutely have to start with İpek. She's the object of Ka's longing, yes, but she's also symbolic of Kars itself, beautiful, intelligent, but carrying this deep sadness.
Mm-hmm.
She's the daughter of the hotel owner where Ka stays, and she's recently divorced from an Islamist political candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So she embodies that modern Turkish woman, caught right on their fault line, pulled between the Western-leaning path Kot seems to offer and the passionate traditional Islamic revival represented by her sister and her ex-husband.
And then you have the men who embody the ideological extremes. On the militant secular side, there's Sun Azaim.
Oh, Sun Azaim.
He's such a, well, almost ridiculous figure, but incredibly dangerous too. An aging, kind of washed up actor who literally stages a military coup inside a theater.
Right, during a play.
He turns this patriotic play into a horrifying live action bloodbath. It feels like Pamuk is really satirizing Turkey's history of military interventions here, showing how political power can sometimes rely more on dramatic, absurd spectacle than any real substance. It's like tyranny as performance art.
It is. And directly countering that theatrical secularism, you have Blue Orlasevert in Turkish.
Blue.
He's the intellectual Islamist.
Yeah.
Very charismatic, utterly convinced of his cause. And crucially, Pook tells us he's a former communist.
That's interesting.
It suggests his conviction isn't just religious. It's about finding an absolute truth, whether political or religious. He represents the sheer pull, the allure of absolute certainty. And he becomes Kaz's rival, both philosophically Kaz's deep doubt versus Blue's lethal conviction, and romantically as well.
Right, because of Kadife.
Exactly. We also need to mention Kadife, Apek's younger sister. She's Blue's lover and a leader among the Headscarf girls. She's the devout idealist in many ways. Her deeply personal convictions about faith and modesty become weaponized by the state, by the political factions.
She really represents the devastating human cost, doesn't she, when individual conscience gets turned into political ammunition?
Absolutely. The narrative structure itself is incredibly tight. It unfolds over those three snowbound days, giving the novel this intense feeling of claustrophobia, escalating tension. It feels almost like a stage play itself. Or a Greek tragedy.
So walk us through those 3 days. What happens?
Okay, day one is just this immediate, almost dizzying plunge into chaos. King Cry arrives. He has that reunion with Giefbeck. But the main event is him going to the National Theater.
For Sun Azim's play.
Yes, My Fatherland or My Headscarf.
Oh.
And then in this truly shocking moment, the play turns into a real military coup. Soldiers storm the stage. Real shots are fired. People are killed.
Horrifying.
It is. But here's the strange twist for Ka. Witnessing this horror, this intensity, this pressure, it actually inspires him. In this moment of weird, almost spiritual elation, he writes his first poem in years, and he immediately calls it Snow.
Wow. That tension really sets the stage, doesn't it? So day two, that's where the juxtaposition becomes almost unbearable.
Exactly. Day two is defined by this unbelievable split. On one hand, Kai experiences this intense romantic bliss with Epek. They confess their love, share these intimate moments in the hotel, creating this private, perfect little world of snow and romance.
A bubble.
A bubble, yes. While simultaneously, just outside that hotel room door, he's being forced into service as this reluctant messenger. He has to navigate the terrifying political landscape, running messages back and forth between the secular authorities, now led by Sun Azaim, and the Islamist underground, led by Blue.
So he's literally caught in the middle.
Physically and philosophically. And that messenger role forces the novel's crucial debate between Ka and Blue. They argue about God, about the West, about what makes life meaningful. Ka, the secular man filled with doubt, is searching for some kind of universal truth that can still embrace human failings, human joy.
While Blue.
Blue, the man of absolute conviction, sees only corruption and doubt. He sees the necessity of absolute faith, absolute rule. It's this fundamental gap artistic doubt versus lethal certainty that really fuels the coming tragedy.
That mix of private dream and public danger feels like it's building towards something terrible on day three.
It is. Day three is the climax. Sun Azaim, needing to cement his power and show the absolute dominance of the secular state, stages this final, incredibly cruel theatrical humiliation.
What does he do?
He forces Kadi, the very symbol of the headscarf movement, onto the stage and demands she publicly remove her headscarf.
Mm.
It's an act of profound psychological violence performed for the city.
And meanwhile,
Ka is completely consumed by his desire to secure this future life with Epek. He comes to believe that Blue is the main obstacle standing between him and his dream of taking Epek away from Kars, back to Germany, to happiness.
Oh.
And in a moment of just deeply selfish calculation, putting his personal happiness above everything else, he makes a fatal moral compromise. He betrays Blue's location to Sine's authorities.
And that betrayal, it shatters everything.
Completely. Blue is hunted down and killed. And Epek, when she realizes what Ka has done, horrified, not just by the political violence, but by the profound moral cowardice, the cold calculation behind Ka's choice, She rejects him utterly.
His private dream had a terrible public cost.
And she can't forgive him for paying it. So Kyle leaves Kars alone. His dream is destroyed. All he carries with him is his book of poems, those 19 verses he wrote, arranged like a snowflake diagram he imagined.
On the ending, the epilogue.
The novel ends with an epilogue, narrated by this friend figure, also named Orhan, who investigates the events years later. And the final tragedy is confirmed. Kyle was murdered in Frankfurt some years after leaving Kars, likely as retribution for his betrayal. The political world he tried so hard to both observe and ignore finally caught up with him.
Which brings us right back to these deeper themes. Let's start with the artist's dilemma. Kaz's art, those poems, they seem to strive for universal truth, for beauty, for transcendence.
Yes, the snowflake pattern suggests this perfect, intricate, almost divine structure.
But the story itself proves that his attempt to separate his private aesthetic world from the political violence around him ultimately led to his moral downfall. Pamuk seems to be saying, quite painfully, that in a world saturated with violent ideology, neutrality just isn't possible. Not really.
And that failure connects directly to one of the novel's core philosophical ideas about happiness. There's that quote, "Happiness is the longing for repetition." Ka spent 12 years exiled, longing to repeat that perfect past he imagined with Wu Pek. But his desperate attempt to freeze that past, to recreate it, required him to commit that terrible betrayal in the present.
So the novel suggests that purely personal happiness, divorced from social and political reality, it's an illusion, or at least a dangerous one.
I think so. If you try to carve out some artificial bubble for private joy, ignoring the chaos outside, that chaos will eventually invade and destroy it. It's quite a bleak message, in a way.
It's deeply ironic, too, isn't it? The secular, doubtful intellectual is the one who commits the most profound moral sin, driven by this very personal, almost sentimental desire.
While the figure of absolute religious conviction, Blue, is perhaps more politically ruthless, but doesn't commit that same kind of personal betrayal.
And speaking of performance, we have to come back to the theatricality that runs through everything. Sun Azim literally performs his tyranny.
Yes, the coup as theater.
But Pamuk seems to imply that all the political figures, maybe even the ideological stances themselves, are kinds of performances, roles assigned by history, by ideology.
It does raise that unsettling question about authenticity, doesn't it? Are these deeply held political identities truly authentic convictions? Or are they just rigid, predictable roles people feel forced to play with within this ongoing Turkish national drama? If the coup is a play, maybe the whole ideological conflict is just this long-running, violent show that no one knows how to stop.
So reflecting on all this, the isolation, the violence, the failed search for happiness in 1990s Kars, what does it teach us now in our hyper-connected, arguably just as polarized modern world?
For me, the lasting feeling from Snow is this profound melancholy, because the core message feels timeless. Ideological rigidity, whether it's secular, religious, or political, it seems to just corrode our human capacity for empathy, for connection.
It tracks people.
It leaves the individual feeling helpless, caught between these powerful, absolute certainties. Pamuk seems to be warning that if we chase the absolute, whatever form it takes, we risk losing the ability to truly connect with anyone who holds a different view.
The tragedy is how easily conviction, even the conviction that you're protecting your own fragile happiness, can justify destroying others. It's a really devastating read, powerful but devastating.
I think the novel really demonstrates the profound tragedy of pursuing any kind of absolute certainty, religious or secular, and the crushing cost that pursuit has on individual freedom and morality.
So if the isolated city of Kars showed us that both conviction and doubt can ultimately lead to violence and death, what kind of belief, or perhaps what kind of skepticism, can possibly sustain true human dignity and freedom in our world today? That feels like the unsettling question Pamuk leaves us wrestling with long after the snow melts.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.